well as during the meeting. I'm Mindy Riley, and I'm a state representative from the Roseville area, and I'm the chair of the Education K-12 Finance Committee. And I want to welcome you all here to the hearing. And I'm going to start out and just give you an idea of what we're doing tonight. And we will introduce everybody up here at the table and then have a few comments from our staff on the financial ramifications that we want to talk about tonight. And I will then turn the meeting over to Representative Sammy Bolschleiner, your local representative for the area. I first want to start by thanking Superintendent Slesser for helping, and his staff for helping our staff, our committee staff, for setting up the hearing tonight and getting this beautiful facility and all these microphones and everything. And I don't even know where they are, so you can thank them. But, oh, there he is. Okay, very good. Thank you very much. We had very good reports, and we're thrilled that we had such a good welcome to come down here. Thank you. Kim Strom is sitting to my left, and after the legislators have introduced themselves, we'll hear from him, and we're lucky to have him here because he's from House Research, which is nonpartisan, and we can always trust whatever our politics are that we get a really good answer out of him, and he's excellent. So I think you'll learn a lot from what he has to say. After we've heard from him, then Sammy will be chairing the meeting and people will have a chance to testify. I know that many of you have signed up already. And we're going to try to keep comments from people to 3 minutes or less just because we already have a long list. And invariably when people start testifying, then other people think of things. So we want to hear from as many people as possible. Before we go any further, then, I would like to have the legislators introduce themselves, and if they could just do what I did, say their name and what city they represent, what district. And we could start maybe with Representative Olson down at the end, and work our way this way.
Thank you, Rose. It's good to be here. I'm Representative Mark Olson from the Big Lake area, Sherman County, north of the Twin Cities. I want to compliment you on your wonderful facility, well kept. I thought it was practically brand new. So, appreciate how you care for it. Thank you.
And I'm Representative Carol McFarland. I'm a freshman from White Bear Lake, Minnesota.
I'm Representative Robin Brown. I am District 27A, which is the Albert Lee area.
My name is Kim Strong. I'm a staff person with the House.
I'm Representative Sandy Wolfsfire, and I'm delighted to see so many people here represent Red Wing, as well as Cannon Falls, Goodhue, Lake City, and Wabasha.
I'm Terry Morrow. I live in St. Peter, and I represent Nicholas County and part of Citizen County.
Good evening. My name is Pat Garofalo. I represent the district just to the west of here. We traveled through Marchand Township or Ravenna Township or cities of Hampton, Meadville, and Trier, all the way up to 35. That's the district I represent. And, even though I'm a Republican, you'll notice that Sheriff Riley, I'm her favorite student.
Good evening. My name is Representative Denise Dietrich. I represent the city of Champlin and a portion of Coon Rapids, which is about 30 miles north of Minneapolis. And Pat is also known as being extremely humble.
Okay, thank you. I'm now going to turn the meeting over to Representative Sandy Wolfsleiter. And of course, if she served on the Education K-12 Finance Committee, like I would have liked her to, since she came from the school board in Cannon Falls, she, I'm sure, would be my favorite pupil. She chose the tax committee. But she was, because she has always been a champion for children, she was very instrumental in getting this hearing here and offered to host and help work on it and really encouraged us to come. So I want to thank you for that, and I'm now going to turn the meeting over to you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chair Bradley. A few things first. We should thank the school board members that are here from Red Wing. And I have a list here that Terry Speakas and Tim Kelly and Steve O'Keefe and Neil Malgard are here. And if I've missed someone, please let me know. But thank you. I know that we also have a few superintendents here. I see Mr. Mainstrom. I know I just saw Mr. Peterson walk in from Cannon Falls and Thompson from the school board in Cannon Falls. I know that Todd Sesker is planning on coming. He is the superintendent of Cannon Falls. There is also a National Honor Society recognition tonight, and his daughter is receiving an award. So he'll be a little late. At this time, I know that Mr. Kelly wants to come up and give a welcome, so maybe before I go any further, if Mr. Kelly could come forward.
Thank you, Representative Walker. Chairperson Driving, that's with the Education Committee. My name is Tim Kelly. I'm the chair of the Redding School Board here. And certainly on behalf of the school board, the school district, and the rest of the community around Redding, we're honored to host this event, and we appreciate certainly the time and the travel that you put in to come out state here to outstate Minnesota to have your meeting here. So we're honored to host this event, and we look forward to the rest of the evening. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Just a little history to the committee. I was looking into Goodhue County, and at one time we had 169 school districts in Goodhue County, and today there are 7. So when we talk about change, I can't imagine a bigger change than going from 169 to 7. And actually, it's appropriate in this district to have this hearing in Redmond, because the first district in Goodhue County was started in Redmond at 4th Street and East Avenue. So that's just a little history as to why we're here. And with that, I know we've asked health research staff to provide an overview of the most recent K-12 education finance bill. So that person is right here.
Thank you. I've been asked to spend about 5 minutes explaining what the legislature did to school districts this last year. And I'll try to do that in summary terms for you. You certainly, during your questions, could ask me to expand on some of those issues if there are some that you're concerned about. I think there were packets that were passed around that you all got that have a blue cover sheet. What I'd like to do is talk very briefly about how the school district revenue was distributed this last year, and then we'll watch some examples of the Red Wing School District of what that means. The legislature budgets on a 2-year basis, or what we call a biennial basis. So that means last year's legislature essentially set a 2-year budget for the state, including for the school. There may or may not be a supplemental education bill this next year, depending on how the forecasts turn out. But at this point in time, there's a 2-year budget that was set by last year's legislature. The legislature appropriated roughly $790 million for the 2-year period. That was about the same amount that was appropriated for the previous 2-year period. And if you look at the blue cover sheet on the top of the documents that you've got, you can see how the legislature allocated that money. The majority, or the single largest chunk of that money, not quite a majority of the money, went into special education funding. 46% of that, roughly $790 million, was for special education funding in school districts. That money is distributed to school districts based on their special education costs, and we'll talk about this a little more in just a moment. 35% of that money went out on a straight dollar per pupil basis on what we call the basic formula allowance. That was enough to provide a 2% increase on the formula allowance the first year and an additional 1%. In fact, I think that was about 35% of the total money. There's another 5% of the money that goes out to categorical programs that are within the general education program. Those are for things like transportation, varsity, and compensatory. That money is not evenly distributed among school districts. Instead, it's distributed based on the school district's characteristics. And then the remaining chunk on this pie chart of 14% that's listed as other, this is primarily one-time capital money for the school district. $40 per pupil the first year and $55 the second year are available for school technology purposes. So that $95 is there for 2 years. That's not ongoing money. That's one-time money. But that makes up the bulk of that category listed as other money. So that's essentially a very brief summary of the $790 million that the legislature spent on top of what the baseline spending for K-12 education was going to be for this school year and the following school year. The next sheet, the folks sheet in the packet, explains a little bit of what's happening in the special education area, and I think speaks to why the legislature decided to allocate nearly half the new money to the special education area. The term cross-subsidy is one that legislators use to discuss the difference between special education costs and special education revenue. And you can see on the front page of this chart that in 2002, the difference between those two was about $300 million. So in other words, the state was putting in all the $300 million of what was needed to fund special education costs. That remaining $300 million had to come out of each school district's individual budget. You can see, however, by 2007, the end of the last biennium, that that amount had grown to about $530 million. So that meant essentially that school districts were spending $530 million more than the legislature was appropriating for special education services. The chart that got three lines on it, the very top line shows where that cross subsidy would have grown if the legislature had not acted. And you can see that in 2009 that the expected cross subsidy would be about $650 million. The bottom line with the triangles on it shows what happened after the legislative actions this last year. And you can see that there was a one-year drop that was very precipitous from about the $530 million to just under $400 million of the cross subsidy for the current year, but then that's going to start growing again in the future. And you can see, essentially, that the legislature bought down that subsidy by a fairly substantial amount. If you turn the page to the back of that close sheet, you can see this in another way. This way, it's about $80 that are spent. You can see that the state's commitment to special education has been fairly static since 2002. It declined a little bit between 2002 and 2004, but from 2004 forward, it was about at the same level. And you can see there again the triangle line of the legislative action this last session. So essentially what this means is the legislature spent nearly half of the new money on special education, closed the cross-subsidy some, but not completely, and school districts are still going to have to pay a fair portion of special education costs out of their other general operating money. The next page, and the green page that's in your packet, is just a very quick summary of how the legislature views changes in school funding. The legislature tends to measure from base, not from the previous year, but from base, which essentially is what would the school districts have received if the state had not acted, if the state legislature had not appropriated a different amount of money. Now, this is a slightly different way of budgeting than most school districts. Most school districts will budget year to year. So while the dollar values and percentages are accurate on this sheet, it's a different way of looking at it, and so you may see some differences when you look at how the school district is doing their budget. And if you look at that total on line 7 at the bottom there in column F, you can see that for the Red Wing School District, compared to what the base budget would have been, the first year has a fairly good increase of about 5% over what the base budget would have been for the Red Wing School District. And you can see that those categories are listed in columns 2 through 6. In column E there, the basic revenue went up $135 per pupil. Other general education revenue, that 5% on the pie chart, went up about $10 per pupil for Red Wing. Then on line 5, the special education revenue is up a pretty substantial amount, about $229 per pupil unit, for that total of $425. So in the first year, in fiscal year 2008, that 5% increase is about the state average for Red Wing and is probably considered by most to be an okay increase. In the second year, fiscal year 2009, that's next school year, you can see the same numbers presented here, but here's where the issue where the legislature measures the base is going to be different than how districts measure from year to year. And you can see in the very bottom right-hand corner here that the increase in the second year over base is 6.4%. But most school district people will tell you, well, really the way they'd like to see that number is year to year, and over a 5% increase in the first year, this is just an additional 1.4%. So they're both true numbers, they're both accurate numbers telling part of the same story, but one is measuring toward base and the other is measuring year to year. The reason the legislature measures toward base is that's essentially what they have to pay for in their budgeting process. They measure from where the old law would have been to where the law ends up at. So most school districts, and I think Red Wing obviously can speak for themselves, but most school districts are going to find the first year of school funding pretty sufficient, is my guess. In the second year, most school districts are going to find that increase very small. And I think you're going to see and hear a lot about that during the next year here at the legislature. So in summary, the legislature appropriated about $790 million of additional funds for schools. About half of that is going to special education. On the basic formula, on the money that all school districts get, on that per pupil amount, there's a 2% increase the first year and a 1% increase the second.
Great. Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Strong from the committee members? Great. Well, before we begin taking comments, I'd like to remind you that we'd like to hear from as many people as possible who are interested in speaking, and ask that you keep in mind about 3 minutes. And we do have some timers on each side. And I do have several people that have signed up when they first came in, so we'll start with those individuals. And again, we'll just try and get as many people as possible to speak. And let's go from there. Okay. The first person on the list is Lisa Hanson.
Distinguished members of the Education Finance Committee, thank you for bringing me this evening, and especially thank you to Sandy Goldschlager for having you in Redding. My name is Lisa Hanson, and I've been teaching health in Redding for nearly 12 years. First, I must say how blessed I am to be teaching under school board superintendent principal to support an all-inclusive, medically active sex education curriculum. Second, I really need to thank the teachers, administrators, and parents before me who made it possible. Unfortunately, my colleagues across the state aren't as blessed. Many districts will only allow access-only programs to be taught in their schools. This may be due to parental pressure, federal grants, or a combination of both. If you read in any newspaper in the past week, you're aware of the failure of these access-only programs. Tens of millions of dollars in federal grant money has gone to these schools only to find out that they don't work. There's no evidence that shows a delay in the initiation of sex, a quicker return to access once sexual activity has occurred, or a reduction in the number of sexual partners a person has. How is this cost-effective? Schools like Redmond High School that teach an all-inclusive medically active sex education are, on the other hand, showing a delay in the initiation of sex, a reduction in the frequency of sex, a reduction in the number of sexual partners, and an increase in the common contraceptive use. In fact, records could be found students who receive an all-inclusive medically active sex education had greater, quote, confidence in their ability to say no to unwanted sex, end quote. Yet we have never received any federal grant money for our programs. Can you explain this to me? I have a budget of $200 for the entire year. This includes paper clips, staples, market board markers, videos, etc. Can you imagine what I can do with the money the gas and solar programs are receiving? Every health educator I talk to promotes abstinence. To think that we don't is absolutely ridiculous. Students who take my class know that abstinence is the best option at this time of life. Postponing sexual activity will lead to higher self-esteem, lower risk of cervical cancer, STIs, and pregnancy. Health class covers many topics other than sexuality. Self-esteem, decision-making, mental health, depression, suicide, grieving, stress, nutrition, weight management, illegal drugs, addiction, and disease prevention. These topics are not usually covered in other classes, yet health is no longer a sacred class. Due to continued loss of federal money, many school districts have elected to drop health education classes from their schools to use the money in other areas. How unfortunate. This generation of teenagers is the first in history to have a low life expectancy than their parents. Why, you might ask? Obesity. Not only are high schools around the state dropping health classes, they're also dropping physical education. How are young people going to learn to keep themselves healthy if we don't educate them? Healthcare costs are the highest that we've ever been. We're larger than we've ever been. Without a health education requirement by the state that includes a comprehensive, all-inclusive, medically active sex education unit, what kind of future are our children and grandchildren going to have? Thank you.
Thank you. Yes,
sweetie. Good evening, and thank you for the opportunity. My name is Patricia Queen, and I am here as a representative of the American Association of University Women, the Red Wing Area Branch. I'm also the immediate past state president of that organization with its 3,500 members in 35 branches all across the state. For over 125 years, AAUW has been a strong advocate for public support for public education. We support adequate and equitable funding for quality public education for all students. We oppose the use of public funds for non-public elementary and secondary education, and we support vigorous enforcement of Title IX and all other civil rights laws pertaining to education. But I want to stress the first point tonight, adequate and equitable funding. It affects all of the other points I'll make. Providing a quality education must begin very early. AAUW supports full funding of early childhood and kindergarten education, treating those learners equitably with the same funding as older learners. For those of you who are into dollars and economics, and I would guess the Finance Committee is, this comes as no surprise. The earlier we begin to help students be successful learners, the less money we will need to spend later. Some of you may have read a pertinent article that ran in Tuesday's Star Tribune listing Minnesota, 36th of the 50 states, in the percentage of four-year-olds in pre-kindergarten classes in 2006, with 1.8% of those students attending the state program. As the article says, early childhood programs show the biggest bang for the buck. A $20,000 per child two-year investment could show a return of up to 20% for society each year of the child's adult life. We believe the basic formula funding level must be increased and be equitable. Consider the skyrocketing costs of transportation, utilities, insurance, building maintenance, as well as classroom costs. Keep in mind it's not unusual for an American history textbook to cost $50 to $60 a piece. And consider that class sizes remain too high in so many districts across the state. There are four mainstream American Lit classes here in Redwing High School. The current student counts in those classes are 38, 39, 37, 39. We also support Lisa Hansen's focus on comprehensive sex and health education for the safety of our students. Both houses passed such a bill last year only to have it vetoed. We urge you to support and pass it once again. Please make quality education a top priority. It is for AAUW. Thank you.
That's right. At the end there was a bill that was vetoed. So which bill was that? Which number has it?
I'm sorry.
Chair Gregory, I'm going to, I'll answer that one because I don't know. The education bill was not vetoed at all. Answer Representative Brackett's question, and knowing him, he knows the answer, and he's asking us to get the issue out there. We know his behavior from the committee, and it's a good thing to get it out there. The education bill was in negotiations in the conference committee, and then the governor did not want that heaped in there, so it was, you know, you were right in the sense that it was a kid being vetoed, but it was not actually vetoed because
not on the floor.
Exactly. He got it out before it got into the final bill, and then he signed the bill that was passed. But the gist of it is true that he, you know, implied that it might be vetoed if it was still in there. So we need to work on it again.
Thank you.
And I want to make a point that I forgot earlier to the AAUW. They put on a beautiful reception prior to the hearing, and I want to thank you.
Okay, I have Kevin Horvath. All right. Jim Bell.
Good evening. Thank you for coming down to Red Wing as an educator here at the high school. I appreciate the comments. We always give a big amount of applause for our custodial staff, everybody who works hard here throughout the course of the year to try and keep this facility as nice as that. And I too serve think this building looks like. It's homeless. So I appreciate that, and I know that our administration and the rest of my faculty colleagues feel the same way. I am not as polished as Lisa, I'm as sweet as you, as you have, as you. I come prepared. Other than I wanted to ask for a little more clarity regarding legal legislation, Mrs. Sweeney, and if I may, I want to thank Mrs. Sweeney as well for reading off the numbers of students in my classes. That was kind of nice of you. But nonetheless, regarding the legislation, I believe Mrs. Sweeney, if somebody could recall, did she have the title for the legislation? I did not have that in front of me. For the legislation that wasn't quite vetoed?
It was part of the education bill?
Right. Okay, part of the education, but it wasn't part related to the health care initiative for the statewide teachers' health plan. And I'm not sure that this committee would want to address that, but I was curious, and hopefully, if we get more feedback on it and how we can have that brought up again, so we can push that through the legislature again, and hopefully force the governor to allow us to do that. So if somebody who's interested in negotiations in the district that's trying to do the best they can for kids, for the entire community, and has to struggle through the health care issue every single time it goes to negotiations, looking at a potential, maybe not cure-all, something that can certainly help both ends, unions as well as districts. I'm just wondering if we can get some answers on how we can get that legislation passed through against the Olympic veto. And thank you.
Thank you. If we have a lot of people signed up, so we're going to try and get through as many as we can, but if there is some time, Chair Greiling just mentioned to me that we certainly will try and answer some of these questions yet tonight, but we're trying really hard to hear from as many people as possible. So thank you all. Next, I have Lynn
I come to this with a little different perspective. I'm an educational assistant. I've worked in the district for 15 years. I'm fortunate that I get to go into many different classrooms, see different kinds of kids, different kinds of strategies being applied. I work in special ed. I think what fears me is that where we're going, our classes are going to be so huge. In science, for example, to do a lab is actually dangerous. It's so crowded. How do you work with some of the things that you want to hands-on with those kids? It's scary. Other classes that I'm in, sometimes there's only a few students that I'm responsible for, but there's so many that we miss, and so many kids that need that extra touch, that extra little support to make it, and they're getting lost in the shuffle. It scares me that you look at the desk in the classroom and it's falling apart. Where are we going with these kids? What are we giving them? What are we showing them? And where do we say, hey, we're here for you, but can you use that desk to take what I want to do? Can you sit in that table? That every time you sit there, you're touching your books and your papers with your hand on the top because it's all flat. It just scares me that we're not there for the kids. I think we have a phenomenal school district. I think that we have fantastic teachers. Everybody gives their heart and soul to these kids. I've seen these teachers put their own money more and more every year into what they're teaching these kids. What they're doing. But where is the support? We need that.
Patty Roberts. Good evening and welcome to the appointment. I'm an elementary principal here in Milwaukee at our Tennessee Elementary School, which is kindergarten, first and second grade. I have two issues that I'd like to address this evening with you, one of which to address the negativity with regards to funding policy that I really think is impacting each and every student in my school. And so I'd
might respond to that or the information regarding that. And the second is a positive program that we've put in place at Sunnyside over the last 2 years that I really would like you to consider when regarding how we're going to prioritize the funding that we are looking at for our school. First of all, the negative impact. I think most of the issues that I'm concerned about really fall under the category of unfunded mandates. These mandates, which are certainly very well intended and are there for very good purposes, but are unfunded, include but are not limited to the state and federal government accountability testing, the support which we need to accomplish these statewide tasks and tests, such as materials, staffing, technology, training. We do not have the money to do it adequately, therefore money is needed to come out of our general fund to accomplish those tasks. Obviously, special education, which was alluded to in the report given at the beginning of tonight's presentation, even though there's been an increase in the state funding for special education, as was noted, it is still not adequately being funded. It is not fully being funded. With great justification for these programs, obviously, I'm a huge advocate for special education programming, as our students are. But it does constantly exceed the funding that's being provided. Title I funding, even though I certainly understand it's a federal program, I think that the illusion is that many times with a federal program being funded through Title I, that is enough for addressing the needs of non-special education students who are at risk. This is simply not the case. Gifted education is another targeted mandated program. There are funded dollars, but again, we're in your focus and not enough money. Others could be included in this category would be health and safety money, school violence, chemical health, and we could go on. But because these programs, very well-intended programs again, are underfunded, in order for us at the school level to meet these requirements, we are taking essential dollars out of the classroom, the general classroom. And this is the classroom in my building that looks like 27 kids in the kindergarten, looks like 28 kids in the second grade. And these are kids that are not receiving the targeted dollars that I saw in your pie chart. The general classroom is full of students without a target, without these needs, but should be given the full opportunity to receive a high-quality education just as the targeted groups do. Due to these mandates, the only answer for us to provide them for the students is to take dollars away from these classrooms. I feel this is a disservice for our regular kids. This means that the quality one-on-one time, the small group time that children should have with a teacher simply isn't available when we have class sizes inside of the school. In addition, this means less dollars for adequate curriculum materials, manipulatives, simply desks and chairs. We haven't had any desks and chairs since I taught there, which is 15 to 20 years ago. We are imposing unintended barriers to general education groups. Because of the trickle-down, we need to fund the mandated programs through our general education fund, our regular kids are missing out. Research clearly supports that, and then I would like to talk about positive programs, certainly. Research clearly supports, as was mentioned by Mrs. Swing, early intervention is the way to go. We should be targeting, if we're going to target dollars, there. By providing adequate funding for all-day, everyday kindergarten education, our district made that commitment 2 years ago. Obviously, we're doing it without enough funding. We are trying to provide ways that we can meet the needs of our students before they become these targeted kids. The FUE-Connected program has made a huge difference in the readiness of our students for the rigors of academics, learning to read, as well as social, emotional, and physical development of our primary age students. This readiness has been supported by assessment data and significant decrease in academically at-risk students in first grade. In addition, staff report that all-day kindergarten experience allow them to hit the ground running, and they are much more activated to a full-day program when they begin. This program has also been highly effective in catching our students who are coming into kindergarten with no or little preschool or structured learning experience. So I can go on, supporting evidence that suggests that fully funding all-day everyday kindergarten is money well spent, and money which will proactively address the needs of our students before they become these targeted students, and will provide equal access to highly quality, quality education for all of our students, including our regular, non-label specific students. So if we're going to target, here's what I would suggest. Money to hire highly qualified teachers for all the way kindergarten, with adequate support staff, money for necessary curriculum materials, money to retrofit buildings and to equip development in appropriate kindergarten spaces, and please limit our class sizes at the primary level to 20 more less.
Teresa Borenstedt.
Hello, my name is Teresa Borenstedt, and I teach children science, fifth grade science, and language arts at Twin Bucks Middle School. You need to know I'm not a person who is afraid of change. My proof of that is that after 19 years of teaching fifth grade in the fall of 2006, I transferred to teach in the middle school. I know most people transfer out, but I actually chose to go there. It's a great place. I'm here to talk about state testing and adequate progress and the sanctions that are placed upon school districts because of students not making adequate early progress, specifically kids who aren't getting reduced lunch. And my concern for those children is that consideration is not given to the fact that some of these kids are homeless. Some of these kids have parents who have chemical issues. Some of these kids have parents who have mental health issues. Sometimes their parents don't know how to read or fill out the forms to even get free and reduced lunch because they're too complicated and involved. And my concern is that we want to teach them math. We want to teach them to read, and we are trying our best to do that. But if you were 12 and you were sitting in math class and you didn't know when you went home if you were going to whose house you were staying at, whether this week you would be sleeping on the floor or have a bed to sleep on, whether when you get home your parents will be drunk or sober, I don't think you really care about an MCA test. I think it would be hard for you to concentrate on math. And my concern is that we're not adequately funded in education, and then we are having social programs that help these families to become healthy again. And I would ask you to consider those issues in the next study session. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Stan Slesser, superintendent here in Red Wings District, and as I've often said, a real blessing to be here and to be in this community. I first want to thank the committee. I think it is not only symbolic, but extremely real that you are here sitting in front of us and not always in the Twin Cities. So very, very nice of you to be coming here. It's a great message. Also want to thank you for reducing the cross-subsidy in special education. As I talked to Representative Walschlager last year, we said that was our number one priority. Thank you so much for being instrumental in that. A couple of things very quickly on needs, and then a couple of success stories. First of all, as I take a look at funding in Minnesota and take a look at the 99 districts that went out for referendum, I would encourage the legislature to continue what I think some people are doing, which is to examine the overall funding structures for education. That's where the meat of this is all going to come from. We need equalization, and children should not receive an unequal education depending on their zip code, place of birth, where they're growing up, the ability of that community to pass a referendum. What is being told to us, and I get part of it and I agree with part of it, is that this could be part of a strong Minnesota tradition of local funding for schools. That I do not disagree with. It can be part of that. But if in fact many of the 99 are going out saying, if we don't give this, we're laying off 100 teachers. If we don't give this, fees are going up. Then to me, that's not putting the extra layer on education. So just for whatever that's worth. I would support everything that's been said about the tremendous leverage point of early childhood education. Many of you know Art Rolnick from the Federal Reserve Bank. Many of you have probably heard or read his literature. No one that I know of in the Midwest has done more research on the cost-benefit analysis of solid early childhood education. he has taken an economist's point of view and shown a return, encouraged the legislature to listen to him and his associates. In terms of success stories, I want to point out that in the midst of challenges at every one of our buildings, our teachers and administrators are looking to restructure, looking at that schedule that often confines us and saying, what can we do? At every building, we are moving teachers about to work with kids to intervene in reading and mathematics. We're working to recruit parents to take over some duties so that education associates might work with our teachers and reach more kids one-on-one. At the middle school, we are doubling reading periods through a gold standard Read 180 federal program. And we're also, I just came from a meeting where we're going to start restructuring our mathematics department to reach out to kids that need more help. Finally, we were blessed to recently hear that we were awarded $133,000 from the Department of Ed for an AP grant to really muscle up our AP and pre-AP programs. I went to a conference the other day, the National Gifted Conference. AP is making a strong, strong growth in the United States. No state is contributing more to that growth than Minnesota. So I thank you for those types of categorical and competitive source of funding. Again, please take a look at the whole structure of educational funding. Thank you.
Brad Johnson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, welcome to Redmond. My name is Brad Johnson, I'm the finance director of the school district here. And I just have a comment that in a prior job as county auditor and treasurer, I had a number of my superintendents in the county call me and complain about the complexities of the funding formula. I suggested they go to the legislature about it. Their comment was, well, I don't want to do that work, it's going to get worse. That's not a comment on the last session. I just got a few facts to add to the funding structure that's been so well explained by a number of our school district. Our general education aid per pupil has increased from fiscal 03 to fiscal 08 from 6,075 to 6,286. Now that's a total of 3.46% over 6 years, 0.6% a year. So the numbers are an increase of 0.14%, minus 0.1.15, 0.38%, 1.9, and 2.1. Now our state auditors say we should be figuring on 4% inflation on expenditures every year. So there's no way that's going to quite meet that number. One other thing, with aid not indexed to inflation, what we notice is a shift to tax authority. The operating capital budget we have here is one example of that. In fiscal 03 and 04, aid covered 100% of that. In 05, it went to 71%, 68% in 06, 31% in 07, and 21% in 08. The rest shifted to the property taxes. Now, we're a district that has a heavy dependence on nuclear plant here, and I think some of you are aware of that. It's going to decline the tax base. It was 70% of our school's tax base, it's now about 35% due to legislation, tax court, and so on. So that's been a major issue here. And certainly, as with other districts, we're dependent on operating levies to run too, and that's a question that comes up with the shift to taxes. And other issues. Again, Ms. Sweeney and others have touched on that. Textbooks, how often do you turn them over at this? To keep them current, they need to be turned over. Technology, we've had issues even technology after to do the testing that we need to do. Utilities, we're budgeted to 6% right now for electricity. We've seen some of our buildings increasing at 22% a year. Fuel, transportation, just like everyone else, our transportation budget jumped from $1.4 million to $1.8 million. So these are all issues that are getting us, and the general aid is one big piece of that. Again, his example showed that it's increasing at a fairly low rate right now. Thank you.
Todd Custer.
Thank you.
Sean Vivas.
Hello. My name is Sean Vivas. I'm a graduate of Redwood High School in 2005 and at the University. First off, I'd like to say thank you for coming to my town. I heard through the grapevine about this kind of study, comicals. Often as a 20-year-old, you can hold your representatives yourself. And thought I'd put my emphasis on the arts in particular. I was a very involved person in the arts at high school. I was in theater and choir. And Red Wing is a perfect place to be involved in arts. We had the Stone Sheldon Theater down in the town. This theater, as you can see, is very well kept. And our art teachers are one of the best that I've seen. In judging from other students' perspectives in college, we are very privileged to have such an experience for others such as this. And in these times of financial difficulties, I would say to remember that arts are a vital part of Minnesota and our society in general. It's not to brought them to see them as a cut to make up for other areas of the educational system. And so it's like this, become the advocate of my generation, as so many of us are actually disenfranchised by our leaders. We don't see things being done, we see things being done at an unethical level. And from what I've heard in my experiences with politics, is that our generation is unique in the fact that so many of us simply don't care, won't care. And I hope that through what the thing most affects us is education, which can be regulated by you through that, you can show us that you care about us and that our system works. Thank you.
Roger Sweeney.
I'm speaking to you about the status of school media programs in Minnesota, and I meant to suggest one little thing that you can do that may or may not cost you anything, depending upon what you want to put into it. School media programs are key elements of achieving the mission of nurturing and developing learning on a lifetime basis. Current research shows that school media programs have a strong positive effect on student achievement. Among the general powers that the state gives to independent school districts is this provision. The board may provide library facilities as part of its school equipment according to the standards of the Commissioner of Education. I urge that the Minnesota Legislature, that the Education Committee, examine this provision for the following reasons. The provision originated in the 1920s, when the concept of the school libraries was relatively new, and text-based teaching was the norm. The terminology library facilities is at odds with the current professional concept of school media programs. The statute is permissive, as though a school media program is optional and not an essential integral part of full and successful student learning. The state regards school media programs as optional, therefore that fosters inequality from district to district and even from school to school within the same district. The provision references official standards for the school media program when the legislature abolished past program rules at the onset of the profile of learning and has not directed any commissioner of education to develop new ones. I believe that reconsideration of Subdivision 9 and action to shift thinking from facilities to program is basic to a strengthened, equitable, and effective role for school media integration throughout the state. You will find many within the library community who are willing to give assistance in this reconsideration. Thank you for this opportunity. Because of the time limits, I prepared a correct standard document that I will use.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Cassidy.
Hello, thank you for coming. There is an economically feasible way for our society to help children reach their highest academic performance, raise test scores, decrease violence, improve attention abilities, reduce classroom disruption, while at the same time address many of the devastating health issues facing our children today. Many schools in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, New York, Florida have all found the key to unlocking even greater potential from their student body, and we in Minnesota can do the same. I'm nervous. Over the past generation, changes in the standard American diet are having astonishingly negative health consequences on our children. There is ample scientific evidence indicating that the food people eat has a significant effect on behavior, learning, and health. The public schools do not allow children to consume alcohol in school because it's illegal, but really because we know that it has a negative effect on learning, behavior, and health. So does poor quality food. Schools such as Whitefish Middle School in Montana, 803 New York City Public Schools, Central High School in Appleton, Wisconsin, have eliminated processed food and synthetic chemicals in what they serve children, and have seen significantly better behavior in the classroom and hallways, less violence, less littering, higher concentration, higher academic achievement, and higher test scores. What we feed children matters. The following food ingredients make up the insurmountable quantity of what children are fed in schools. High fructose corn syrup and other processed corn byproducts, hydrogenated oils, refined grains, irradiated food, factory farmed meats and fillers, factory farmed hormone and antibiotic-induced dairy products, artificial chemicals, dye, and preservatives. Scientific evidence has mounted indicating that consuming these products increases violence, reduces the ability to concentrate, contributes disproportionately to weight gain, affects mental health and the ability to learn. What should children eat? Whole, natural foods, such as fresh and frozen vegetables, fresh fruit, whole grains, a healthy source of calcium, a healthy source of protein, such as non-irradiated hormone antibiotic filler-free low-fat meats, herbivore fish, beans, and nuts. Minnesota schools need to get rid of the pop, the juices, the candies, the chips, the sweetened box cereals, chocolate milk, crackers, cookies, popsicles, cupcakes in the classrooms, breakfast and lunch programs. Get rid of the synthetic chemicals filling children's brains and serve them wholesome food and water, clean water. This is common sense, but is it too expensive? Feeding our children's bodies also feeds their minds. Children like fresh, wholesome, good food when given the opportunity. Food waste in schools that adopt healthful food choices find that the cafeteria food waste drops significantly. It is cheaper to pay for good food than higher-end security systems. It is cheaper to nourish our children now than to imprison them in jails later or deal with an unskilled labor force. It is cheaper to pay for the food that children's developing bodies thrive on than inexpensive food products that hold them back from being all they can be. Thank you.
You're going to probably say this last name wrong. Linda Desch?
That was my mistake. She's not speaking
to me. Oh, okay. Mike Martini?
Well, thank you for coming down to Redwood tonight, and my name is Michael Martini. I'm a teacher at language arts, an English teacher at the Minnesota Correctional Facility here in Redwood. And unfortunately, you don't have purview over my program in terms of finance. We're funded by the judicial finance. But I would encourage you, because of all of the issues that we have seen here, they all come to bear quite heavily on my program, because we are a program of 109 at this point today, adjudicated males, and 75% of them are special education. we could use an extra dose of help in terms of funding for our year-round programs. The Department of Corrections is strapped, as you might guess, to provide the necessary funding for education at our facility. We're really the only state-funded juvenile facility. Our other juvenile facility is Thistleby, and that's funded by Grand Rapids Public Schools, or through the formula. So I would just encourage you to maybe work with your partners on judicial finance, because I know that you know education better than they do. I think they know corrections, but you know education. It might help get a few extra dollars for my program. We really serve a very needy group of students, many of whom read at a third to fifth grade level, 17.8 years of age average. They're with me about an average of 20 months. We can get them graduated. We do get them graduated. We do everything we can. We get them through DSTs. They love us. Today was the end of the quarter. I had a whole bunch of juvenile delinquents that were really wanting to hurt me because I might not give them an A. They wouldn't really hurt me, but they sure wanted an A. Lord knows how that happened, but we do a really good job of encouraging these kids to be successful. And with extra funding, with provision for fully funding the education programs at the correctional facility, but I think we'll give these kids a much better start once they get out of the correctional system. And Lord knows we want a correctional system with an education. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Cecilia Dodge.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for coming to Red Wing. I'm Cecilia Dodge, Representative Wolfhager. Thanks for inviting folks to come down here. And Jim Strong, thank you for coming. It's great to see you. I'm Cecilia Dodge. I live in Cannon Falls. I'm actually a special education director for St. Paul Public Schools. And I first wanted to thank you for your efforts to increase special education funding last session. It's really been helpful. I especially want to recognize Tim for presenting that great graph about how we're making a dent in the cross-subsidy, but it won't last for long, so that's a concern. I'm here to tell you that we're working hard on school reform all across Minnesota, and I'm new to St. Paul Public Schools, and the pace is incredible there. But I came from Hastings Schools, and I know Cannon Falls, I know Red Wing, and everybody's working hard at closing the achievement gap and achieving good results for children and youth with disabilities. And so while we are pushing for those accountability pieces, which we firmly believe in, as you know, funding is an issue because the change process in education is such a difficult thing to accomplish. And it takes time. So one thing I'm here to say is help us have the time, change takes time, and that it takes a consistent source of funding. So as Superintendent Fletcher said, going out to the public for funding is a difficult thing. I know Hastings didn't pass the referendum. And I don't know what they're going to do. So I wanted to share that with you. The things that we need greater support on, clearly the funding. We need to do some more comprehensive staff development to implement all the reform that we're doing. And that's raising teacher quality. It is also enhancing school leadership. We need strong school leaders to accomplish these really tough things. And as my husband, Mike Martini, said, some of the kids that he's serving, some of the kids that we're serving at St. Paul School, some of the kids that we're serving here at Redwing School are coming to us with, you know, fewer skills than we'd like them to have, and we have a lot of challenges serving some of our kids and families. Funding early childhood education and all the kindergarten, working on high school initiatives, and really looking at what research-based practices can help our high schools and help our kids make strong, successful transitions to adulthood in the world of work. And then, kind of back to my fully funding mandate piece. So, thanks for coming.
My name is Todd Dusker. I'm the superintendent of Camp Falls. Thank you, Representative Wilsonlager and panel, for allowing me to come down here and being patient with him while I was going through the National Honor Society this season with my daughter. In the past 5 years, our district at Camp Falls has cut nearly $1.3 million. And in the past 5 years, according to the data from the Citizens League at the website www.propertytaxfacts.minnesota, our revenue per student for general education has increased on average about 0.7% per year for the past 8 years. These increases don't even cover uncontrollable inflationary increases such as fuel, utilities, workman's comp, liability insurance, or even our milk prices went up $13,000 this year. These costs certainly do not cover unfunded mandates such as AYP, Title I, Title II, Title III, Title IV, and the red tape that goes along with them, that it takes a long time to apply for these grants. E-rates, 403D changes that we're dealing with right now, NCA2 testing, supervision, and again, red tape, and even GASB mandates right now that we're asked to do. And these are huge changes that have occurred without having any staff, without having cut staff. More is being asked of schools, and yet no one is willing to offer these services for free. Schools are expected to do these things with no need of revenue. Special education in our district is another bottomless pit. This federal mandate takes money away from our general education program. Kids like mine are now pitted against kids that are getting special education services. Because we are required by federal law to provide these services, my kids pay less. We cut the amount of money we put towards technology, materials, books, and even teachers. It does not make any sense that you have a local levy for these programs. In fact, parents are already becoming resentful that we are taking away dollars that we're intended to spend on kids equally. Can you imagine how the community would feel if we were asked specifically to fund special education services, but not regular ed services? Nothing will improve, and this is my opinion, nothing's going to improve financially unless the special education rules is what. There are two components that legislatures I believe should take a look at coming this legislative session in the future, and you've probably heard about these already. One is PS Minnesota. And that again, the task force has worked hard to find a logical and equitable way to fund schools. It still should be looked at carefully, reviewed, and revised according to what all schools' needs are. The other piece of literature that I think is interesting and worth looking at is Minnesota's Promise Document. Some of you may have heard of that too. And that is the vision for, I think, our future in Minnesota's future. It's a promise that I believe the educational community can keep if the legislatures are willing to take a leap forward financially. And finally, the last thing I'd like to talk about, and I'm sure you've heard this too, is a referendum meeting. I appreciate seeing Representative Browning at the 10:30 meeting that was up there in the corner watching the school districts that did not pass their referendums. We were fortunate enough to pass two of our referendums. We passed a referendum that renews the current $500 per student levy, and we were fortunate to approve a building project as well. But, you know, that doesn't happen with all schools. The concern I have is the inequity that has become obvious across the state of Minnesota with the haves and the have-nots. A lot of people are, I guess the analogy they used up at St. Paul was the levy roulette game. And I don't think our group worked any harder than some of the other groups that were out there that failed the referendum. We just happened to have, we were fortunate enough to have people that were very supportive and voted in favor of ours. But our students get an extra $500. We have about $1,300, so if you take $1,300 times $500, that's about how much we end up with. Sounds like Leroy Owens Cranford, they get $1,444 per student. Southland gets $1,440 per student. Now, these are rural communities. Wabasha Kelvin gets $1,115 per student. St. Louis Park gets $1,560 per student extra, above and beyond the state. And Edina gets $1,783 per student. As a superintendent, I would love to have an extra $1,200 per student that I don't get right now. These are just items that I'd like the legislature to think about, and it's something that I believe is a fairness issue more than anything else, is trying to figure out the form of poor education, trying to figure out the gap by the letter reference, and also the bottom get of the special education. So, thanks.
Thank you. I don't have any other names on the list. We have about 10, 15 minutes here, so please line up at the microphone and let's have at it. And for the record, please state your name.
My name is Lois Burns. Good evening, Chair Dreierling, Representative Wolfslocker, and committee members. I live in Red Wing, and I'm a member of the League of Women Voters. I'm not speaking for them, but my remarks will be in line with the League's position that all Minnesota children should have equal access to a good public education. I've also been a teacher for over 45 years, primarily working with young children, their families, and caregivers. But my remarks tonight come from my role as a grandmother and are personal statements. I also want to put a face on the issue of early education that others have so eloquently discussed. My grandson, Timothy, had serious language delay. At 3 years of age, his primary means of communication was through gestures and isolated sounds, but not words or sentences appropriate for his age. My daughter and he enrolled in an early childhood family education class in the Anoka-Hennepin School District. With the observation and guidance of the teaching staff, he was referred to a speech pathologist who confirmed his language delay. He spent 2 years in a language development preschool, part of the school district's special education program. His progress was remarkable, resulting in a child who was confident and skilled in his language usage. When he was 5, the family had moved, and he was enrolled in full-day, everyday kindergarten in Melrose, Minnesota. His parents and I were concerned about his success, not only because of his still emerging language skills, but because he was a late August birthday and would be the youngest in his class. However, he loved kindergarten, then went on to be a successful first grader, and now in second grade reads everything he could get his hands on. He can also tell me the complete life cycle of the leopard frogs he's raising in his frog habitat. None of this would have been possible without early detection of his learning delay and appropriate remediation. My suggestions to you are to make serious plans to increase funding for early childhood family education so that all young children can have early and appropriate learning experiences, and that any obstacles to their school success can be found and treated early. Increased funding for special education, as has been mentioned by many, is also needed to narrow the gap between what federal funding offers to states and the funds required to reach all children in need. As a citizen, an early childhood professional, and Timothy's grandmother, I thank you for your attention to these important issues in Minnesota education.
I want to welcome Chairperson McGreeley as well as the State Representative. My name is Stan Dogan. I retired after 30 years of serving as a special director in this district. I want to thank the legislature for addressing the issue of the cross subsidy. I know it's not the original governor's proposal. The state funding formula has led a state concept for over 35 years. It is the funding part that has come from the legislature that gets passed. Cross-subsidy, the year I retired, was equal to the amount of cuts that had cut up K-12 the following year. So I appreciate that 45% of the funding, but I would encourage you to put that into the ongoing funding process. In 1982, when there was a shortfall of state funding, the local school board was given the authority to make up that difference through a levy of the local authority. But I would hope it would not have to do that. There's a real concern about district equity and funding. I think Superintendent Sessler has addressed that. But I think the legislature needs to address what is the range of that funding. It is more than just formula. It is more than just levies that pass and don't pass and model levy. It also gets into complex formulas and compensatory aid. You know, and have a difference of number of students who have at risk, but then have multiples of that when you get into higher degrees. Not trying to take away from the district, but kind of level the playing field. I think my niece teaches in a suburban school district, and she's in a choice inclusion model. And our district had a drop foreign language from the middle school year because of funding. Funding and equity and opportunities for education should be dependent on what school district your parents look at. So I encourage legislators to look at the equity and the range of the discrepancies. And I also recommend that you truly try to follow through on school funding to make it simple, make it consistent, and able to project what funding would be down the road. In my 30 years, I've seen 7 task forces. In the last 10, I've seen funding just grow more complex. And the ability to project what the funding is going to become more complex. In special education, I've seen a swing of $600,000 in the neighboring school district in just a few days from what was projected. The state said they were funding the efforts. No, we changed the formula to here. No, this is the ratios here. So I encourage the legislature to follow through on this and be able to give all districts, including rural districts, what you represent, the good fair and the free market education.
Good evening. Well, thanks to the committee for coming down here and for giving me the opportunity to be heard tonight. My name is Chris Cole. I'm the director of the Hugh Wabashaw Sexual Assault Services, and I'm going to take you off topic for a second into my world. First of all, this summer, the Minnesota Department of Health released a report on the cost of sexual violence in the state of Minnesota, and in 2005, the state of Minnesota spent $8 billion on sexual violence, which averages out to $1,540 per person per resident of the state. In addition, national estimates are that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually molested before they reach the age of 18. So, obviously, I think you can draw where I'm headed with this, which is back to what Ms. Green and Ms. Hansen have commented on in terms of comprehensive sexual education. This is so essential, and I encourage you to continue to push. I know that we've come close in the past, and that we were very close last year. Please bring it again this year. I cannot tell you the impact that sexual violence has on young people. It affects their abilities to trust, to develop normal boundaries, to develop healthy relationships, to from eating disorders to chemical health issues. There are so many different ways that this affects sleep, and it's essential that we provide opportunities for kids to learn comprehensive sexual education, have conversations about healthy sexuality, so that they have the ability, the voice, and the place to talk about unhealthy sexuality as well. Sexual violence doesn't have a voice if there's not a place where we can talk about healthy aspects first. Without that, the shame, the confusion, the myths that are out there keep our children silent and prevent them from seeking help and seeking the services they need. As you well know, education is key to prevention of all. 1 in 4 and 1 in 6 is epidemic. It's ridiculous. There's no reason that we should stand for it. And we can do things as simple as past comprehensive sexual education to make an impact on the $8 billion that we spent on results.
Hello, my name is Kevin Moraj. I'm a science teacher at the high school. I've been in the department chair for a number of years, and I was evidently on the list earlier. All I apologize for my tardiness. I'll serve my detention tomorrow at 6 in the morning. Supervisor. Welcome to Red Wing. I apologize for following my notes closely here, but as the years go by, you follow the notes a little closer. I have 3 concerns about state funding and legislation regarding our schools. First is my class sizes are the largest in my 20-year career at at a time when we're being asked to raise the bar, heavily limited lab confinement, that larger classes becomes more and more difficult to reach all the students. We're able to find, in addition to this, newly mandated testing in science threatens to take as many as 12 80s from my students' education regarding due to some technical problems that would be involved with that. What I previously taught during these 12 days of testing is now lost. It's ironic that the test is evaluating material that the test is displacing. As a head varsity football coach here in Red Wing, it's very clear to me that the best investment for my football budget is to stipend another coach. By adding a coach, I reduce my athlete coach ratio and make more connections with my players. In the case of my classroom, my biology classes are 34 and 35 far exceeding the lab space designed for 24 students. 24 students is what the National Science Foundation recommends for the science classroom. Even crazier is the fact that as I have outgrown my classroom with students in search for a new storage space, our school is threatened with fines as materials I store on top of cabinets is considered by OSHA to be a fire hazard. Our OSHA has no limit to the number of desks that can be crammed into a classroom, blocking walkways and fire exits. My second concern, I'm a senior science teacher here at Redwood High School. I'm a teacher of honors biology and biology. However, I've also built three homes personally and worked summers building homes with a friend who is a contractor. My father always told me to learn a skill with my head and my hands. In addition to building homes, I make blocks, cabinets, and I'm a certified welder. I truly understand the value of vocational education. This is why I'm so concerned with the message we're giving our students that they're left behind are failures if they don't attend college. Why are we trying to shove every student through a college prep track? As my colleague and chemistry teacher says, if the 2012 mandate for every student to pass the tax chemistry before graduating prevails, the chemistry taught in 2012 will not be taught at the same high level the students receive today. I graduated with a friend who went to an 18-month weld inspection program at Hutchinson Vo-Tech and immediately made six figures upon graduation. I went to a four-year college where I had $15,000 in loans and started teaching for less than $20,000. We need mechanics, plumbers, carpenters, sheetrockers, and roofers. These are honorable professions with the ability to earn much more money in college grads. Not every student can or should be on a college contract. I feel bad giving them the message that they're left behind are failures if they cannot pursue this track. I've had many students over the years who may not have been gifted in the academic world, but were very gifted in vocational skills. Finally, my third concern here is that I actually considered this question. Should we honor the federal mandate to educate every child if it's left in the states to fully fund special education? The special education program number times here. This is an extremely noble yet expensive mandate that the government obviously to this point has and cannot afford. I propose that the feds put their money where their mouth is, or I suggest that we ignore the mandate. Is it possible that our government has a champagne taste on a bare budget? Maybe some hard but responsible decisions need to be made about what we can afford to publicly fund and what must be funded privately. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Thank you. We have a few minutes for questions.
Thank you.
Any
Hi, I'm Heather Hanson, and I'm a senior at Redwood High School. I just wanted to make some comments on the gifted and talented, and to the gifted and talented funding that the state gives us. For the first time in a long time, the gifted and talented funding in Red Wing has actually been going up. We've had to cut a lot of programs. When I was in middle school, I missed out by just a couple of years on being able to be in the honors reading class. Now we're being able to reinstate a part-time gifted and talented coordinator. We had a full-time position, but now we have one part-time person to take care of all of the abused and talented students in our entire district. Though this is an improvement, this apparent lack of support from higher levels of government is disconcerting. We live in a culture that's fixed on meeting benchmarks and standards in order to be proclaimed satisfactory. Sometimes this is good, ensuring that no child is left behind the learning curve. But often those who are already satisfactory are forgotten. Why can we leave no child behind but leave many ahead? It is just as tragic for a child who is frustrated by already knowing the material than a child who is frustrated from a lack of understanding. I'm well aware that funding is scarce in Minnesota, but our current efforts in continuing housing are almost counterintuitive. If we were crafting a wedge, we would pay special attention to the very edge of the wedge. That's what would really make a difference. The same can be said of gifted and talented funding. It is just as essential to fund the students with the most potential as it is to fund those with the most problems. The students who have the most potential are also the ones who want to go out and compete at the highest levels in our nation and won't be able to compete with the others if they are not given the resources. In addition, these critical issues should not rely on the fickle local referendums and tax levies. The state should take responsibility for our best and our brightest. And if our spending formula cannot be readily altered, there are several simple steps that we could take. We could join with 15 other states in instituting a math and science school or even an art school. We could partner with many independent organizations like the one that work on gifted and talented issues, just like the one that had a conference in Minneapolis this past week, in order to find solutions. If we do not take action now, we will never be able to say that we truly left no child behind. Thank you.
Well, I just want to thank everybody for all the testimony on behalf of all of us. All of us up here, it really helps us when we get out in the greater part of the state and hear things. Some things we hear at the Capitol, and we have it underscored here tonight, and other things we hear that we can check into, like the Red Wing Correctional Facility funding issues that we don't deal with in the Education Committee, but we should talk to the Judiciary Committee and make sure that the students are getting their fair share and that that's funded properly when the Judiciary Committee has other missions besides education. There have been a lot of people that have testified on the comprehensive sex education, and I know that Chairman Carlos Mariani chairs the policy committee where that was started and is committed to hearing that and sending it on to us again to put in our education finance omnibus bill. And I know that many of us are committed to having that get a full vote on the floor and not just be discussed closed doors and knocked off the table before we get a chance to have it in the greater bill. We had some people commented on libraries and technology, and we did put significant amounts of new money this year into libraries that hadn't been funded with an increase for 20 years, but that was more the city and county libraries. And I know that with all the budget cuts, some of the school libraries need more attention, and we need to pay more attention to that. We did have money, one-time money, as Mr. Strong said, for technology that will help. But again, we need to have more of the ongoing money. Someone mentioned school lunches that we had and having more healthy food. We did give a small increase to school funding for school lunches this year that we hope to keep building on, because that if we're going to have really healthy food that doesn't cause kids to have poor eating habits, the schools need more help on that. They can't afford what they would like. And we did add a little bit to get the talented funding for the last speaker that talked about that. That's because we wanted to support gifted and talented and not just other kids who may not reach those heights. I appreciate all the comments on special education, because we certainly did put our eggs in that basket with almost half of the funding this year. And it is something that someone called it a Bible specific, one of the superintendents, and we are examining all of our rules and regulations in the interim for special ed that exceed the federal requirements. Anything Minnesota does that doesn't have to be done according to the federal government. And next year we'll examine those things and see, in addition to putting more money in all the time, do we need to do everything we're doing that's not required by the federal government, or is there some more efficient way to do it? And we also have some pilots that we funded for earlier intervention that was mentioned by several people, so that we can try to head kids off competing in special ed if we help them earlier, and then they won't cost so much money in the long run. So, but we also, the main thing for next year, and several people mentioned this, is the adequate and equitable funding. And we are, I'm co-chairing a task force that is starting, we started at our first meeting with the PS Minnesota report, that's Public Schools Minnesota, and we looked at their recommendations. We have the next meeting of that group tomorrow, and then we're meeting again so that we can prepare our recommendations for the legislature. And then during the legislative session, the Education Finance Committee will be spending a substantial amount of our time looking at this to try to come up with things that we can actually agree upon and then take to probably the next funding year. So all of these things you talked about are helpful. Some we worked on last year and need to do better, and some we will work on for next year, and I'm sure that we will hear from any of you again. You're welcome to contact any of us, or better yet, contact your representative, Representative Wolfschlager, who will keep us very well informed because she does do that.
All right, well, thank you. We certainly heard a wide range of issues, and I'm really proud of all of you that spoke tonight. And, I don't know, I think it's best to hear from the people. So, again, thank you for coming. Thank you for speaking up. And with that, we need to adjourn.